All right, we're ready for John chapter 8. Here is our outline we're following from Baxter. We're in the first major section of Jesus' public ministry to the Jews. We're going to see a conflict that is continuing. We've already seen a conflict starting in chapter 5 that continues. That's where we are in chapters 5 through 10. We'll finish that subsection next time. But this has to do with witness and conflict. This is where Jesus is taking his message to the Jews, and there is conflict. And we saw that in our study last time in chapter 7, and we see it again here in chapter 8. More about that in a moment. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1, he is the true light. Chapter 2, all right, the power and authority of Christ. Chapter 3, a teacher came from God. Who said that? Nicodemus said that. Chapter 4. All right, yeah, that message went to the Samaritans and then to the Galileans. So we have his Galilean ministry not developed here like it is in the Synoptics, but it is developed briefly. All right, chapter 5 begins this new subsection. All right, witness for Christ. He claimed that he worked a miracle. This is where the controversy started. He worked a miracle, and they said, well, you've done wrong, and Jesus claimed God was his father, and then that really put the fat in the fire, and now things are rolling, and they're ready to kill him. He gives evidence and witnesses for who he is. Chapter 6, Jesus is the bread of life. People are following him because he had fed the 5,000, and they were filled, and he rebukes them for that. Chapter 7, last time. All right, there's controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacle. And with that controversy in mind, we come now to chapter 8, question 1. What's this chapter about? Very good, yes. He is the light of the world, and he deals with a dark nation. We base that on verse 12. Jesus spoke to them again and said, I'm the light of the world. Well, he'd said he's the bread of life. He is the water of life. We'll see in chapter 10, he's the door. Number of things he says he is. Here he says he is the light of the world. Now, that's not surprising to us because we were introduced to that concept in chapter we just reviewed. Jesus is the light of the world, chapter 1. All right. So he says he's the light of the world, and he who follows me shall not walk in darkness. So notice the contrasted darkness. So that's why I call this chapter, the light of the world deals with a dark nation. And we're going to see that develop throughout this chapter. Does that make sense? That concept is going to flow throughout the chapter. So let's see what we have in chapter 8. He starts off with the test of an adulterer. This section begins with Jesus teaching in the temple area. And so the Pharisees, this dark nation, by dark nation, I'm talking about the Jews who thought they were the light of the world, are actually in darkness, and Jesus is bringing light to them. And so they test him by bringing an adulterer to him. And so here's that dark nation of the sinful woman, by the way, and this sinful nation. Both are in darkness, and Jesus brings light. We'll see that develop in verses 1 through 11. Then he shifts in verses 12 to 20 to talk about the witness of the Father. That is, branching off of this concept of the dark nation in verses 1 through 11, starting in chapter 12, I'm the light of the world. And if you follow me, you'll not be walking in darkness like this nation, like this woman. Well, that causes controversy. 21 to 30, we see the sin of disobedience. So we have the test of an adulterer, the witness of the Father, the sin of disobedience like this nation has done. So he offers them freedom, verses 31 to 47. They are offended. And then we have the answer of deity. They charge him with having a demon. They ask him a question about, were you before Abraham? Are you greater than our father Abraham? And then they pick up stones. So there are three things he responded to. And thus I call that the answer of deity. Does that make sense where we're going? And how all of those thread into this dark nation. So This is typical of the prophets' writings in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Amos and others, is they paint a dark picture, and out of that dark picture, the brightness of the days of the Messiah. The dark picture, our canvas, is going to be painted in 1 through 11. Does that make sense? And out of that, Jesus is the light that brings light to a dark nation. So let's get to the dark canvas now in verses 1 through 11. Question number, let's get a question or two out of the way. Yeah, let's get question number two. What dilemma did Jesus put the Pharisees in by telling them to cast the first stone at the woman? All right. All right. Yeah, he puts them in this dilemma because if they don't, by their own admission, they don't respect Moses. If they do, they're in trouble with the Romans. That was the dilemma they had hoped to put him in, and they walk away in a dilemma that they don't know how to deal with. We'll get to that here in a second. So let's get underway here with the test of an adulterer. Let's start with verses 1 and 2. We have some ground to cover, number of verses, so we're going to have to summarize some sections. After this controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles, which was in Jerusalem, he's still in the area. He goes out to the Mount of Olives, just a little ways from Jerusalem out on the east side. He goes out to the Mount of Olives, apparently for the night. Now, early in the morning, he came back to the temple, and the people came to him. Throngs or crowds of people are still coming. Some of them are coming at least. And he sat down and he taught them. And so as a rabbi would teach, he's teaching and exhorting the people. So he's now teaching in the temple area. Now, the Pharisees bring an adulterous woman to him. Now, this gets quite interesting to me, that they brought him a woman caught in adultery and set her in the midst, and they said, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Not the reputation of adultery, not that we were told she's guilty of adultery. We caught her in the very act. Now, I don't trust the Pharisees to be telling the truth about that, number one, but we'll take them at their word. If that's the case, that raises a question. Where is the man? Where was he? If you're really interested in executing the law and obeying the law, should he not have also been stoned and punished as per the law? Which shows they're not really interested in obeying the law. They're interested. Let's get ahead of ourselves. Verse 6, they did this, testing him. They think they're going to put him in a dilemma. And so they caught the person in the very act, according to verse 4. And they said, Moses in the law commanded that they should be stoned. And what do you say? Well, did Moses say the adulterer should be stoned? Yes, absolutely. Leviticus 20 and Deuteronomy 22 both say, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall be stoned to death. So we have more than one reference, but Deuteronomy 22, I think, is the primary passage. Leviticus 20 may be alluded to. They're not quoting a passage. They're just saying it's taught in the law. So which one are they referring to? I'm not sure. Probably Deuteronomy 22. But be that as it may, the law had said they ought to be stoned to death. What do you say? They seem to be trying to put him in dilemma with in conflict with Moses. So here we are in the temple area. They're thinking, we've got him in a rock in a hard place. If he says stone him, stone her, he's in trouble with the Romans. If he says not, we've got him against Moses and in conflict with the Jews. We've got Jesus in a dilemma. They did this testing him that they might have something to accuse him of. All right. Not much we need to comment on there. So let's go further to how Jesus responds. How did Jesus respond to their question? All right. Notice verse 6b. He stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. Woods, in his work on John, suggests that writing on the ground was common among the Jews, even to this day, as a deliberate sign of silence and ignoring. And so deliberately showing. And so was that what Jesus was doing? Well, he was ignoring them, or he was silent, What was he writing? Either we're not told, which we're not, if he actually was writing something, or it may be more just scribbling or doodling, as we would call it. He's just drawing or writing upon the ground, ignoring. The point is, he is deliberately silent. Why is he doing that? Perhaps to give them thought to think about the dilemma, because he's about to put them in one. It's not that he doesn't know how to answer, but they think perhaps maybe he doesn't. Man, we've got him in a rocking heart. Look at him. He's not answering. He doesn't know what to say. All right? So then he says, verse 7, this was a surprise. The one that is without, cast the first stone. Let's stone her. You say she should be, according to the law. You pick up the stone and stone her. The first one that's without sin, let him cast the first stone. Well, the first one that picks one up is saying he's without sin, and his friends are going to know that better than that. Now, let's talk about why they shouldn't. Jesus would not endorse the stoning of that. The Romans have taken away their right of capital punishment. It has to be executed by the Romans. That's why when Jesus is crucified later, they have to have the Roman trial. The Jews can't do that. The Romans have taken that power away from them. This is going to be interesting when we get to verse 32 in a moment, 33 rather, in a moment, when they say, we've never been under bondage to any man. They're under bondage now. They're inconsistent. And so then he stooped down and wrote on the ground again. In other words, I'm going to let you think about that for a little bit. And that's how he responds. Surprising response. Now, let's talk about the dilemma that he just put the Pharisees in. If they don't stone the woman, they must not respect Moses according to their reasoning. Not according to Jesus, but according to their reasoning. Because what they had just said to Jesus, if you don't stone her, you don't respect Moses. What are you going to do, Jesus? You're in a rock and a hard place now. Moses said, stone her. What do you say? If you say, don't stone her, you're against Moses and against the Jews. So he said, all right, y'all start throwing the stones. Go ahead. If you don't, according to your own reasoning, you don't respect Moses. If you do, you're in trouble with the Romans. Y'all deal with that. That's not my problem, it's yours. Now, what was their reaction? Yeah. Verse 9, when they heard that, being convicted in their own conscience, kind of hard to imagine the Pharisees having much of a conscience, but apparently they had some. They went out one by one from the oldest to the last. I'm not going to make much significance of the oldest to the last, but there may be an implication there that the older had a little more conscience perhaps than some of the younger. I don't know. Think about that. I don't know what to make with that. Then Jesus was left alone with the woman. I don't think that means just Jesus and the woman, but Jesus alone as far as the accusers were concerned, because verse 2 had already said a crowd had come together. Does that make sense? And I gather they're still there, that not the whole crowd had left, but their accusers of the Pharisees have left. And concerning that group of accusers, there's no one left but Jesus and this woman. All right, that gets us through verse 11, or verse 9. And then what happens in verses 10 and 11? All right. Jesus asked her a question. I can't get my pages turned here. What did he ask her? Yeah. Where are your accusers? In other words, they've left. Jesus knows that. And has no one condemned you? And well, they've condemned her. The idea of condemning is condemning to death. Condemning to death. That's because that's what they were wanting Jesus to do. That's important in this context. And we'll get to that here in a second. So Jesus then told her at verse 11, neither do I condemn you. Is he not condemning her sin? That's not what he's saying. Remember the context. They wanted Jesus to condemn her to death. They did not condemn her to death. Where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you? Not to death they didn't. They condemned her, but not to death. So neither do I condemn you to death. Does that make sense? That's what he's saying. He's not saying I don't condemn you, because the very next statement is, go and sin no more. He thought she was guilty of sin. So was she taken in the very act? I take so, because Jesus told him to go and sin no more. She must have been a sinner. She must have been an adulterer. And Jesus said, you go and sin no more. So I do condemn your sin, but I'm not going to condemn you to death, because of the same reason that the Pharisees didn't. They were under the rule of the Romans. They were not going to do that. All right. Any questions or comments on verses 1 through 11, this test of an adulterer? Now, what I'm learning in this context is not just they brought a woman to him, but Jesus is teaching, and in order to offset that teaching, Jesus, how are you going to deal with the law of Moses? Here's an adulterer, what are you going to do? And they ended up being in a dilemma. So I see a dark nation here. This is that dark canvas, a woman in sin, and the Pharisees say, oh, how disgusting she is. And they were right about that, but they are just as disgusting because they have no respect for Moses and they have no acceptance of Jesus. They're all a part of a dark nation. Make sense? We've got a dark canvas now. Ready to paint on your canvas? Let's go to verse 12. Look at verse 12. Here's the witness of the Father. What happens in verse 12? Jesus claims, I'm the light of the world. Here's your key verse. I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness like this woman, like the nation of the Jews, like the Pharisees, but have the light of life. Are you interested in being like the Pharisees, like this adulterous woman? There's your dark world, the dark canvas. Jesus said, I'm the light. Let's paint the light. This is the same picture the prophets did. Does that make sense? The prophets always painted a dark picture of a nation in sin. And growing out of that was the brightness of the Messiah. It did it over and over and over through the prophets. All right. Now, with that in mind, let's start at verse 13 now. He said he's the light of the world. Now, the Pharisees say his witness is not true. So now I know how verse 12 to 20 is going to relate to verses 1 through 11. There's the dark nation. Here's the light of the world. What do they say about his witness not being true? You bear witness of yourself, therefore your witness can't be true. I mean, there's nobody else going to. He's already argued this with them in chapter, if you look up here, I'm giving you a hint, chapter 5. Very good. Y'all are perceptive. He's already argued that. Remember that? Remember all the witnesses, the works, the Father, John, the Old Testament scriptures, he gave four additional witnesses. So there are witnesses to who I am, not just my testimony, but they say your witness is not true. So now Jesus makes the point, you Jews are ignorant. This gets pretty pointed. What does he say at verse 14? That's exactly right. Y'all are ignorant because you don't know where I came from and you don't know where I'm going. In other words, you don't understand I came from heaven. You don't understand I am deity in the flesh and you don't know I'm going to ascend back to heaven. That's what you don't understand. And so you're ignorant when you say I don't have true witness. Now, verse 15, you judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. An often misapplied text. According to the flesh is the key phrase. Jesus did judge. When he said, I judge no one, he doesn't mean he doesn't judge. He said he did in chapter 5, in verse 22. He said he did in 7 and 24. He'll say it again in 8 and 26 and 9 and 39. So that's about four times in this book he said he judged. If you didn't get that, it's 5:22, 7:24, 8:26, and 9:39. All right, he does judge. What he's saying is, I don't judge according to the flesh. In other words, you're looking at me and judging I am not true based upon human reasoning and not looking at the revelation of God. I don't judge anyone without looking at it from God's vantage point. Does that make sense? I don't judge according to the flesh. Does that make sense? All right. Now, verse 16 through 20, what does he add? My Father is a witness. Let's start at verse 17. Odd place to start and go back to 16, but what's the point at verse 17? According to your law, takes a testimony of two to be true, the testimony of two men to be true. And so that's repeated multiple times in the law. So your law says the testimony of two is true. Deuteronomy 17, Deuteronomy 19, 15, etc. Now let's go back to 16 and 18. What is his witness? Himself and the Father. Look at verse 16. But I am with the Father who sent me. Verse 18, I am one that bears witness, and my Father who sent me bears witness of me. By the way, let's just footnote right here, and I'm just going to quickly passing make a reference to this. Question number 5, how does this deal with the Pentecostal doctrine of the oneness, one personality in the Godhead? You may not be familiar with that. The UPC, that's United Pentecostal Church, is known for that, the oneness position, that Jesus is the Father, Jesus is the Son, and Jesus is the Holy Spirit. There's one personality in the Godhead. They have a hard time with John 8, I'll tell you. I am one, and my Father's another. And so that takes the testimony of two, and here's two. We are not the same. Father and Son are not the same. Anyway, that's you get a lot of information out of John 8 about that. Now verse 19 and 20, his point is, you don't know me, nor do you know my Father. If you had known me, I'm at the end of verse 19, you had known my Father. These words he spoke in the treasury. No one laid hand on him because his hour hadn't yet come. Controversy is getting tense. And Jesus is saying, there's the witness of the Father. I'm the light of the world. And they said, oh, that's you talking. He said, no, there's more testimony than that. There's the testimony of my Father. You're just ignorant. You don't know where I came from or where I'm going. You don't know who I am. But I'll tell you who I am. And there's more witness to that. There's the witness of the Father, that I am the light of the world. Does that make sense? Up and down, Jess. Back and forth is no. This means go back over that again. All right. Or none of the above. That works as well. I keep losing my remote. I don't know what I did with it. Stuck it somewhere. Under this paper. There we go. Thank you very much. Thank you. All right, 21 to 30. Let's talk about the sin of disobedience. Do you see how these are threading together now? Here's the dark nation, verses 1 through 11. Here is the witness of the Father that I am the light to that dark nation. Now let's talk about the sin of being in the dark nation like the Jews standing there, be it the woman, be it the Pharisees, primarily this Jewish nation. They reject and they are in sin. So let's talk about the destiny of disobedience. There are two verses you want to remember from this text that you take with you when you talk to people about the gospel and you talk to someone about sin, and that's verse 21 and verse 24. Let's get those and then we'll put them back in their context. Verse 21, Jesus said, you will die in your sins, and if you die in sins, where I go, you cannot come. I learned from that that if you die in a state of sin, you can't go to heaven. Verse 24, if you don't believe that he is, you'll die in your sin. If you don't accept Jesus and believe in him and believe what he says and believe who he is, you'll die in a state of sin. So what's the problem of dying in a state of sin? Go back to verse 21. You die in a state of sin, you can't go to heaven. Pretty serious. Make sense? All right. Let's put it in the flow of the context. Verse 21, 24, we just talked about. He's saying to this dark nation, you, because you've rejected me, are going to die in sin. Let's go to verse 24 first. He said, you will die in your sins, for if you do not believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. this affirms two or three things. If you don't believe, you'll die in a state of sin. But I want us to look at the word he here. If you do not believe that I am he, your translation may not have it. If it does, it looks different. It's in italics, which means it has been supplied by translators. Actually, Jesus said, if you do not believe that I am, where have you heard that phrase before? I am. Yes, exactly. Exodus 3, who shall I say that sent me? The I am has sent thee. That was an affirmation of the eternal nature of God. Jesus is making the same claim that the Father did in Exodus 3. Does that make sense? I am. That's the end of the sentence. I am. I am eternal. I have always been, I am now, and always will be. I'm not he, I am, period, end of sentence. It's an affirmation of his eternal nature. If you don't believe in my eternal nature, you'll die in your sins. So this dark nation is going to die in sin, and you can't go and be with Jesus. We saw that in 21 and 22. They thought he's going to do what? He's saying, they thought he must be going to kill himself or something. Now here's the reasons for saying if you're going to die in sin and that you can't go with me. Verse 23 gives two reasons. Yeah, you're from beneath and I'm from above. In other words, I follow God, y'all follow the devil. Verse 23, you're of the world and I'm not. Is that what verse 23 is saying? And because you don't believe, verse 24. So what's the thrust of 21 to 24? This is the destiny of this dark nation and where they're headed. They can't go to heaven if they die in this state of sin. And I came to bring light to them. All right, we're not done. There's the question of his identity. What's asked in verse 25? Who are you? And his response was, same thing I've been telling you. I've been telling you since the beginning I came from the Father. So when this conflict started, let's just take this immediate conflict starting in chapter 5 through 10 in our subsection and as per our outline. Just in that section, he's repeatedly said, I came from the Father, I came from the Father, I came from the Father. Who are you? I've told you from the beginning. Let's look at 26 beginning. He said, I have many things to say to you and judge concerning you. He who sent me is true and speaks to the world those things that I've heard. I speak those things that I heard from him. In other words, I was sent from the Father. You want to know who I am? I was sent from the Father. I'm speaking those things, but they did not understand that he was speaking of the Father. Now, verse 28, he said, when you lift up the Son of Man, what does that refer to? His crucifixion is coming, which will be followed by his resurrection. But when you see the Son of Man lifted up, when the Son of Man is lifted up, then you will know that I am. He is again supplied. I am that eternal one. Well, how would they know that? What's going to happen at his crucifixion? One. All right, that's all going to happen. But even his crucifixion is going to fulfill prophecy. That's one thing. So when you see the Son of Man lifted up and not a bone is broken, if they just stop and think about the prophecies concerning the Messiah, fulfilled exactly. Not a bone was broken. He hung on a tree. They parted his garments, pierced his side. All things that were foretold in prophecy, this is him. But there's something else happened when they crucified him. Do you remember the sun being darkened? Remember the earth quaking? Darkness over the face of the earth, etc. There were a number of instances that suggest this is the Son. Remember the centurion standing by when he was crucified? He hadn't been raised yet. He said, truly this was Son of God. When you see the Son of Man lifted up, you're going to know I'm he. You're wanting evidence and who I am, you're going to know then. And the conclusion was, upon Jesus teaching that, there were many, verse 30, who believed. All right. Here's the dark nation, 1 through 11. The witness of the Father that I am the light to that sinful nation. Here's where y'all are headed if you keep on this track. So here's what I've got to offer you. Freedom. So, he spoke these words and many believed. Verse 30 said, then Jesus said to the Jews who believed on him. Believed him, New King James. King James says believed on him. If you abide in my words, then are you my disciples indeed. Now let's take that verse, not misapplying it, but let's lift it out of the context, just talk about that phrase. If you want to be a true disciple, a Christian is a disciple, Acts 11, 26. A true disciple continues in the word. Show me one that follows the word partially and they don't continue the word. That's not a true disciple. Would you agree? If you continue, then are you my disciples indeed, truly and really. All right. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. A little side note, we learn we can know the truth. So what we have in 31 and 32 is, here's the offer extended. I'm bringing light to this nation, and I can give you freedom from this darkness. Well, what was their reaction, verse 33? Wait a minute. Yeah, we're Abraham's seed. By the way, we're Jews. If you forgot who we are, we're Jews. And never been in bondage to any man. How do you say you should be made free? Well, they're lying about that. They were under bondage at the moment to the Romans, weren't they? They had been in bondage to Babylon, to Syria, Assyria, Persia, and Egypt. Never been in bondage to any man? See, the argument doesn't have to be true to make the argument. Just throw it out there. And that's exactly what they did. Oh, we've never been in bondage. How sayest thou you should be made free? So the offer is extended. The Jews were offended. The need is defended here. So Jesus makes the point, verses 34 to 36, that to be a slave of sin, to commit sin. Let's look at verse 34. That whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And that's his point in 34 to 36. I'm going to comment at verse 35, but that's what he's saying. You commit sin, you're a slave of sin. You say you've never been in bondage, that you're saying you've never sinned. You need freedom because you've sinned. Now, verse 35, a slave does not abide in the house forever, but the son abides forever. He's saying you are in bondage because you sin, and he compares it to the servant of a household who has access to the house, but doesn't have the freedom of the son. I'm the son, Jesus is saying, and I'm offering you freedom. And if I give you freedom, you're free indeed. Does that make sense? So he's defending that offer. And he said, if you're Abraham's seed, verse 37, why are you, he doesn't ask it as a question, but he said, you're Abraham's seed and you seek to kill me because the word has no place in you. In other words, you claim to be descendants of Abraham, but you're out to kill me. But he said, let's talk about being of our fathers. And I'm going to paraphrase verses 38 to 47 in interest of time. Verse 38, we both do what our fathers do. Well, they thought that he was saying they were illegitimate because they're not children of Abraham. We were not born of fornication. We're not illegitimate. That's not what Jesus is saying. I'm not talking about you were not born, you were born of someone else other than Abraham. I'm saying your father is the devil. And the lust of your father you will do. He was a liar from the beginning, and so are you. Look at verse 44. By the way, those who are children of the devil, verse 44, were the same ones who believed on Christ, verse 31, aren't they? Same ones. So his point is, you Jews say Abraham is our father, and you say God is our father. Your father is the devil, because you do exactly what he does. You are a dark nation that needs this freedom. Does that make sense? Now, in the time we got left, let's talk about the answer of deity. There's three things he answers to. They don't know, if you don't know what else to say, this is like arguments politically or arguments religiously today. If you don't know how to answer, you divert. You divert to something else, make a charge. Instead of saying, well, let's talk about whether we're children of the devil, they say, oh, you're crazy. You have a demon. So how does Jesus respond to that? They said, you're a Samaritan, by the way, and you have a demon. That's a low charge. That's a low blow. The Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans, and the Samaritans were viewed as bad, if not worse than Gentiles. And so that was a slam at Jesus. That was a put down. You're worthless. We look at you as unfit. You're not even recognized among Jews. And besides that, you got a demon. And how does he respond? Yeah. You do not, I do not have a demon, for I honor the Father. Demons don't honor the Father. Verse 49. I don't seek my own glory, but the Father's, verse 50. And then verse 51. If you keep my word, anyone who keeps my word, he shall not see death. In other words, here's that freedom again. So here's his answer to a charge. How do you answer the next charge? Are you greater than Abraham? Had a question on that, did we not? Yeah, question 9. How do you answer that? Before Abraham was, I am. There's that expression again. Let's work through that because we've got about 4 minutes and we can do that, and there's only one verse left for the last little bit. Start at verse 54. He said, if I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It is my Father who honors me. And then notice at verse 55, he said that you don't know me nor my Father. And then he says at verse 56, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day and saw it and was glad. Well, he's talking in a spiritual sense that Abraham rejoiced through prophecy and through the promise given to him of the day of the Messiah. I am the fulfillment of that promise of Genesis 12. That's what he's saying. Then the Jews said, you're not 50 years old and you've seen Abraham. You say you've seen Abraham and you talk like you knew Abraham and you're not 50 years old. And he said, before Abraham was, I am. There's that I am, that eternal nature. And it's an affirmation of his eternal nature. I lived, I was alive, I'm deity. I was before Abraham. I was there in the beginning, as the book starts in chapter 1 and verse 1. So again, his eternal nature. I existed before Abraham. And that was his answer to that question. So his answer to a charge, his answer to a question, and then there was an attempt he responded to. What's the attempt? Isn't it interesting? This woman they caught in the very act of adultery. They wanted Jesus to stone her. Jesus said, well, go ahead. Just go ahead, pick up the stones and stone her. They didn't do that. But now they pick up stones and want to stone an innocent man. Isn't that interesting? And he escaped because his time has not yet come. There's more to do, there's more to say, there's more teaching to be done. Does that make sense? All right, so here's this dark nation, the light of the world to a dark nation, the test of an adulterer, the witness of the father, the sin of disobedience, the offer of freedom, the answer of deity. Our time is about gone. I'm just going to list a few things here. I want to mention one of these before we go. We've talked, and we'll start at the bottom. We've talked about the last three, four. I want to go up to the top. You can't redefine adultery. What's that about? In the divorce and remarriage controversy among brethren, the argument is made, I don't have time to develop all of this, but the argument is made that adultery does not refer to the sensual act, the physical act of the sexual act, but it refers to covenant breaking. And so you repent of covenant breaking and continue in that marriage, etc. This woman was taken in the very act. Was she taken in the act of covenant breaking? I don't think so. They're saying we caught her in the sexual act. That's what they're saying. John 8 helps me to understand. You can't redefine adultery because you won't find a passage anywhere where it's used in the sense of covenant breaking. None. Here's an example of that in John 8. And that's a powerful point to make. We're going to stop right there.